back. Some folks, I'm sure, joining for the first time, and many folks back for our third meeting. First meeting focused on the chapter of the Mishnah here, and the second meeting got us into the Gemara, Lamed Bet Amud Aleph through Lamed Bet Amud Bet. And we ended last time with a whole discussion of Tzedek, Tzedek Tirdof, Tzedek Tishpot Amitecha, and all kinds of questions of different modes of justice that might live side by side. A few folks emailed or were in touch in the interim, kind of a sense of what's coming up, or if people wanted to look at things in advance. It's pretty easy. We're just going consecutively through. So, of course, if you want to peek ahead at what comes next, you can just keep going and look ahead with whatever text you like. As I said, I will often take us through various passages in Rashi, occasionally pick a Tosafot. We'll be doing one of those tonight because I want to point out there that illuminates something in the Talmud. But we're not going to do that comprehensively. So the good part of that is there's not really sort of mystery in terms of what's going to happen. There is the possibility of just sort of knowing what's coming up. We are going to pick up from the middle of Lamed Bet Amud Bet. We basically finished what's essentially a lengthy sugya or piece of sugyot last time. And we're going to pick up with the next bit here. It'll require us to go back to the Mishnah just for a moment, and then we'll see where the Gemara picks up from there. So let's just remind ourselves, we're up here at the top where my cursor is at this piska, this little pull quote from the Mishnah, Dinei Mamonot Potrin Vechulei. That's referring back, I'll just take us back to the Mishnah here, all the differences between Dinei Mamonot, monetary or civil law, and Dinei Nefashot, capital law. And one of the things that's laid out here is Dinei Mamonot Potrin Bein Lizchut Bein Lechova, VeDinei Nefashot Potrin Lizchut VeEin Potrin Lechova. So we're going to hear here about how in Dinei Mamonot, in civil monetary law, you open the proceedings in sort of whatever direction you want, whether to the favor of or the detriment of either of the parties. But Dinei Nefashot, Potrin, we open only with Zechut, only to the benefit of the accused in a capital case. And we do not have an opening that is Lechova, that is to the accused detriment. So basically the way the structure of the Gemara is gonna go is each sugya is pretty much gonna take on like a next clause here. You may notice we skipped one. We skipped this clause in the Mishnah. That is to say, we didn't really analyze it. Dinei mamonot bishlosha v'dinei nefashot be'asrimu shlosha, just the numerical composition of the court as being 3 and 23. That doesn't really, apparently that did not merit a significant comment by the Gemara. So we're just moving on to that next phrase, okay? So here we are. Dinei mamonot potrin. The Gemara basically wants to know, what does that opening look like? Okay, that is to say, what is the opening of a capital case in favor of the accused look like? And we're going to get a number of suggestions. So, Hechi Amrinan, what do they say? What do the judges actually say? Amar Rav Yehuda, Hachi Amrinan Laho, Mi Yemar Kedeka Amritu? Rav Yehuda says, you say the following to them. Is it really like you say? Or who says you're right? That is to say, you start off right at the beginning, basically with a broadside against the case that the witnesses have presented. So just going back here to Rashi for a minute, because this is important later. Hechi amrinan biftichat zechut kishakiblu edutan shel edim. Udrashum v'chikrum uva'in lisa v'litein hechi amrinan lahola edim. At the beginning of the capital trial, but what's defined as the beginning? When they accepted, when the witnesses entered their testimony into the record, and there was a drisha v'chakira, an intensive investigation of the validity or consistency of what they're saying, and then you are going to deliberate as a panel and figure out what you think happened. What do you say to the witnesses at that moment? And what you say is, Miye Markida Kamaritu, who says it's like you say it is? Shema Be'etza Batem. Maybe you came because, you know, someone told you or counseled you, maybe even conspiratorially, to come. And that's how we begin trying to save the accused, is basically by going after the testimony of the accusing witnesses and saying some version of, why should I believe you? Okay. Amar le Ula. Ula responds to Rav Yehuda. V'hachasminan leho. Literally, but you're going to thereby muzzle them. Meaning, let's go down here to Rashi, a nice formulation. Literally, we muzzle their mouth, if that's our protocol. If the first thing out of the judge's mouth is contradicting the plausibility of what they're saying, then you effectively muzzle them. And they will reverse themselves immediately. Okay? Meaning, what's the point of taking testimony if the first thing you're going to say to the witnesses is, yeah, we don't really think you're right, okay? So Ula's objection is that's too extreme. Now the Gemara jumps in and says, V'lich samu, go ahead, muzzle them. What do I care? Why is that an objection? Milo Tanya, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, ben Eliezer Omer, Masi'in et ha'edim mimakom lemakom kadei shetitaref da'atan v'yachzeru bahen. There's a braita that has Rabbi Shimon ben Eliezer saying that when witnesses come in a capital case, you kind of march them all around from place to place to literally to make them crazy, is what kadei shetitaref da'atan, but sort of more idiomatically it means so they will get kind of confused and discombobulated, and they will back off of their testimony. In other words, there's an image here of when witnesses come into a capital case, you literally physically exhaust them such that they will end up saying something like, you know what, I don't know what I think anymore, okay? That is to say, the Gemara is arguing against Ula that we seem to have a tradition in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Eliezer that in fact we do try to basically get the Edim to back off their testimony. So what are you so concerned about muzzling them? That seems to be part of our protocol. And now we defend and say, mi dame, really? Those two are not really the same. Hata mimele kamidhu, hacha kadachin an leho bayadai. In that case, where we march them around, it's just they get exhausted and we're testing their resolve. And if they back down, mimela, as a corollary of us marching them around, their testimony will be pushed away. Here, you would actually be actively, as judges, delegitimating their testimony. That's what Ula is objecting to, and that's why he can't stomach Rav Yehuda's suggestion that the way you are potchin lizchut is by saying, miyei markida ka'amritu, who says, it's as you say. Okay. So we now get an Ela Amar Ula, a replacement suggestion. Ela Amar Ula, hachi amrinan, yesh lecha edim lahazimam. Ula says, no, what the judges do is immediately after the witnesses testifying against the defendant, against the accused, enter their testimony, the judges turn to the defendant and say, hey, do you have any way of proving that these guys are edim zomamin? Do you have any way of disqualifying their testimony by saying that you've located someone who was with them in a different geographical place than the alleged crime? So you do not contradict the testimony straight up, but you immediately turn to find ways to delegitimate the testimony. Okay, Amar le Rabba. Rabba then responds to Ula's alternate suggestion and says, "V'chi potchin bizchuto shel ze, shehi chovato shel ze." What kind of an opening for zechut is it when it is going to be to someone else's detriment? Meaning, what happens if you prove someone is an ed zomem, is a conspiratorial witness in a capital case? That person gets executed. So you're beginning a capital case by saying, oh, we don't want anyone to be killed. So the second someone is accused, we're going to try to find a way to get him off. But what good does it do if by getting him off, you're essentially starting the basis for a new criminal trial of the Eid Zomei? Now, the Gemara is going to defend this and say, Umi havya chovato? Really? But it's not really actually to the detriment of the Eid Zomem. Why? Ve'atnan en edim zomemin neheragin ad shi'igamer adin. When it comes to executing conspiratorial witnesses, you actually only execute a conspiratorial witness if a guilty verdict was found prior to the conspiracy being unmasked. Okay? That is to say, if during the process, which is what we seem to be at, you're right at the beginning, and someone's entered testimony accusing someone of, you know, first degree murder, but you haven't sort of had the full deliberation of all the evidence yet, if the witnesses are determined to be conspiratorial at that point, so their testimony is knocked out, but it's not a case of asitem lo kasher zamam la'asot la'achiv. It's not what they plan to do, you carry out to them, which is the normal case of the normal punishment for edim zomim, because without there having been a verdict, they sort of didn't really go the whole distance. Who knows? They might have backed off. Any number of things might have happened. You've got to actually have the witnesses having succeeded in securing a guilty verdict, a death penalty verdict, for them to be edim zomim. So therefore, no problem to impugn them at this early stage of the trial as trying to weigh in lizchut for the benefit of the accused, because that's not going to actually redound to their detriment in any way. So therefore, in order to fix the objection here, we have to say, hachi amena. No. Here's what Rabbah basically meant to say. Ilu shatik hai ad migmar dine umaiti edim umazim leho havya lechovato shel ze. Since there is a scenario where by you saying to the defendant, hey, do you have any way of proving that these guys are conspiratorial witnesses? There's a scenario in which the defendant will sit there quietly until the guilty verdict has been delivered, ad demigmar dineh, and then he'll bring witnesses and nail them as edim zomamin. That could happen just because he didn't figure out how to do it before then. Or once given the suggestion that he can take these guys down as edim zomamin, he plans his revenge very carefully, lets the trial run its course, gets convicted of murder, and then whips out his ironclad evidence that they are edim zomamin. If that is a possible, right, under that scenario, the judges will have been the agents of enabling another person eventually to be executed, all right? And that is Rabbah's core objection here to Ula, is I'm not gonna sign on to a definition of potchin bizchut if it's going to end up in any scenario redounding to someone else's chova. Okay? So, great. I'm going to take us through all of this and then we'll go back. There's a bunch of questions in the chat. This is a sugya I basically want to go through probably three times. One, just reading it through. Two, then getting some of the questions and discussion around it. And then do a sort of higher level reflection on what I think is significant here. All right, so far, what did we get? We got Rav Yehuda's suggestion. We got Ula's suggestion. And now we're going to get Rabbah's suggestion. Ela amar Rabbah, amrinan le, yesh lecha edim lahachachishan. Rabbah says, I don't want to be talking about edim zomamin, about conspiratorial witnesses. I just want to be talking about edei hachachasha, meaning what the judges do is they turn to the defendant at that first moment and say, hey, do you have any witnesses that can contradict what's been said here? What's the difference between edim zomamin and edei hachachasha? Edim zomamin is imanu hayitem. You said the murder happened in New York, you were with us in Chicago. Edei hachachasha is you said the murder happened at 3 p.m. in such and such place, and the murderer was wearing such and such kind of clothing. But we say that the murderer, we also saw something, and the murderer we saw was wearing something different. Okay, and then those are just incompatible testimonies that cancel each other out. No one is determined to be conspiratorial. It's just that, you know, you're not able to actually convict. So that doesn't present the same challenge of no one is going to be disadvantaged. Okay, I think Rashi here too has a nice formulation. La'chishan kegon anu ra'inu oto harug achar kach chai. Okay, another example. Chai v'kayam. The person you're saying was killed, we saw alive later in the day. Dehavya idut b'teila. That just cancels out the testimony. Dehu v'hein p'turin. Both of them are just exempt from any kind of punishment. Ein zomamin ela bi'imanu hayitem. The case of zomamin is only when you prove that they weren't there at all. Okay, so that's the next suggestion. And now, Rav Kahana Amar. So we're now up to explanation 4 of how do you begin a capital case with words of zechut for the defendant. Rav Kahana Amar, midivrechem nizdake ploni. This is a kind of an odd one. The court just says, from what you just said, ploni is going to get off. Okay? The person who is being accused is going to get off. It's almost like a formal assertion of, great, we're very glad you entered evidence to try to convict this person and sentence them to death. But at the end of the day, we feel confident he's going to get off. Okay? Just sort of a statement, court taking sides in some basic way, even as they're then going to go into the evidence and see what they actually have to conclude. Abai v'Rava. Answer 5. De Amrei Tarvayu, both of them said, Amrinan le, I lo katlat lo tidchal. So this is of a very different form. Abai and Rava say, when we say your potrin lizchut, that you start in favor of the accused, what we actually mean is you turn to the accused after that evidence is entered and you say, listen, if you didn't kill anyone, don't be afraid. Okay, that is to say, you basically offer words of comfort and support to the defendant, but you're not engaging the witnesses, you're not suggesting any other way it's going to go. Potzchin l'zchut is like you set a tone in the courtroom of, look, if you're guilty, you deserve to die, but if not, don't be afraid, because we're going to be fair and we're not going to convict anyone who is innocent. And now number 6, Rav Ashi Amar, kol mi sheyodea lo zchut yavo v'yelamed alav. Rav Ashi says you kind of make an announcement. Anyone who has any information that might exonerate this person, let them speak now. All right, which is a kind of more general call for exonerating evidence. All right, those are the 6 things. Let's just go to the end of the sugya here, and then we'll talk this through. Tanya kavatei d'abai v'rava. The Gemara now says we feel that there is a braita. There is a text here that supports Abai and Rava's basic approach of you're just sort of setting a tone of calming them down. And it comes from a discussion about the Sota ritual, about a woman that's suspected by her husband of adultery and brought to the court in the temple, to the Kohen in the temple, the priest in the temple, to figure out basically what happened there. And the opening thing that the Kohen says is, Im lo shachav ish otach v'im lo satit tachat ishech, hi naki. If no other man slept with you, if you did not deviate from fidelity to your husband, then you will be found innocent. And then only after that, v'im lo, right? And if you were, v'at ki satit, but you, if you were unfaithful and strayed from your husband, then such and such bad thing will happen. Meaning what? The order is the Kohen first says, if nothing happened here, then nothing bad will happen. If something bad happened, something bad will happen, says the Braita. Mikan shepotchin bedinei nefashot tchila lizchut. That is to say, this Braita says The basis for beginning in capital cases with zechut comes from the sota case, which is a capital case, because at the end of the day, if the woman is found guilty of adultery, that is a capital crime. And nonetheless, in the context of effectively a kind of a capital trial, you begin with the phrase that says, if nothing bad happened here, so nothing will happen, shows you that that's the way you start. And from the fact that this Braita describes that as potrin bedinei nefashot chila lezechut, shows us that that pticha is basically just about offering kind of reassuring words to the defendant and not necessarily anything more than that. You know, one thing to note here, this is a great passage that I think shows very clearly. We knew this already, but this is not happening in real time, right? That is to say, if there's an actual real context of people having capital trials that they are doing, or even a precise record of how capital trials were handled in the Sanhedrin, you would not have six separate suggestions of what's the way that you open. This is a basic protocol question, right? Much less reaching back to some Braita in Sota that it seems like probably everyone was aware of, but only Abaye and Rava draw on here. So that both shows us how a lot of this is sort of some degree of reconstructing things that we no longer have kind of a clear live tradition on. And also the ways in which all these discussions are on some level about certain values that clearly kind of transcend the local cases here, where I think it's fair to say this is to some degree a reflection of what does it look like to say something in someone's favor, right? When they're in a tight spot, how much of that is actually trying to change the facts, attack the people who are attacking them, how much about it is, you know, reassuring them, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, couple comments here in the chat from Judah. Does a person who commits murder but is not sentenced to death, does he receive any punishment? Yeah, pretty much for the most part, no. That is to say, it's a kind of all or nothing system for the most part. There's the sort of vaguer category that you have in the Rishonim and the medieval commentaries, grounded in passages in the Talmud of makin ve'onshin shalom min haTorah, that sometimes batei din that have actual responsibility for keeping order will need to punish and maybe even execute people without following the real protocols that were supposed to be followed. But technically, within Torah law, as it were, you're either convicted of murder or you're let off. And I think I mentioned this in one of the earlier sessions. That's a little bit connected into a kind of theological backstop here of God will take care of the people who fall through the cracks. We don't have to actually deal with every single case like that. David here asks, how does the timing work according to Ula 2 and Rava 2? Is the question, is there anyone who makes you zomim after all the testimony is done, as Rashi suggested? We're going to go and see a Tosfot about that in a minute, David. So that's a good one. Okay. Braitot can be, anyone can appear in them. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi can be in them. It doesn't mean that there's any, right? There's not like the Mishnah, there's not some redactor. It's just, this happens to state that in that way. Okay.
Hello.
Yeah.
What, this may be really an innocent question. Why is the use of the sota brought as a proof? Since isn't what happened, at least biblically, to the sotas, is not somebody who punishes there, but something happens to her almost divinely, right? She bursts.
Correct.
So how is that a good proof for a court which is going to have to administer the punishment?
Good. So from the perspective of the sugya, right? From the perspective of the sugya, it's a good proof because the braita ends, this is how we know that you are potrin lizchut bedinei nefashot. If you're asking why does the braita itself make that connection, the braita on some level clearly already knows about that practice and I think is searching for some antecedent for it in the Torah and latches onto that.
But it's weak. It's Jerry, but it's weak, right? Because everything in the Sota ritual, when you go through the Gemara and Sota, is to sort of get her to confess, right?
Mm-hmm. Right?
Every move, and it takes forever, is to get her to confess. And when one learns, I mean, so the parallel is very hard, I think.
Good. So look, you may also be providing what I think is a reasonable answer to a different question, which is, Well, if other people knew about this Brita of the Sota, why didn't that? Why wasn't that the definitive answer? So you could say they didn't know it, or you can say they asked your questions, right? And that's why they didn't settle on it. It's, okay, Rabbi thought that, but we think that other Tanaim might have thought differently, and we play out, you know, in a different way.
Turn it around? Namely, if with Sota, whereas Jerry just said, the purpose is to get the Sota to confess, but nevertheless, you don't scare her to begin with. You don't say, if Satit, then, you know, you better watch it and therefore confess. We say, in Lo Satit, you don't have to worry.
Right, so, and therefore what?
So therefore, the point is, it's even more so that the goal is to reassure. Namely, even in a case where you could say the overall purpose of
right.
the Sota ritual is to get it to confess, nevertheless, you start by reassuring, that shows us a very fundamental principle.
Good. So that's how, I think you probably just played out the backroom debate on some level between Abaye and Rava, you know, versus Rabba and the other Amoraim here. Great. Excellent. Okay. So let me take you to this Tosafot, which is first the sort of substantive point, but then gets to a form point that I think is really interesting about this sugya. Okay. So they're picking up on this description of when this happens. All right. Like, Hechi Amrinan, how do we begin this Pticha Lizechut? So up here in the Tosafot, Perash HaKuntras, Kishakiblu Edutan Shel Edim. So Rashi indeed explained, as I said before, that this happens after they already entered the testimony of the witnesses. Okay? So now the Tosfot say, V'im tomar, im kein, b'may chasminan laho, ha-kevan she'igid, shuveno chozeru magid. An obvious challenge to this is there's a principle of kevan she'igid, shuveno chozeru magid. You cannot enter testimony and then say, actually, I want to change my story. Actually, I want to offer entered testimony to the opposite effect. Once testimony has been entered, it's sort of it's gone out of the witness's mouth. It cannot be recalled. I don't know what the principles here are in American law. Would love for people to weigh in on that in a second. So say the Tosafot, right? Well, what do you mean chasminan laho? The whole objection of Ula was, you're going to shut them down and make them back off of their testimony, but they can't back off of their testimony. So how can that be that we are entering this at the point that we are, you know, engaging this p'ticha l'zechut at a point where the testimony has already been entered? The chi tema, and if you want to worm out of that objection, say the Tosafot, sheyachzeru ba'en toch kedei dibur, keperu shakunshus. If you want to say, which actually, if you paid attention, Rashi embedded into his Perush, that no, they're not allowed to change their testimony, but you are allowed to change your story like 2 seconds after you put it in. So you can say, yeah, we saw this guy murder this other person at 3 p.m. on Sunday. Well, actually, we're not so sure. All right, that is just, you know, reversing yourself right there on site. So if you want to say that, that's what we mean. It's after the testimony has been entered, but we're trying to get them to back off. Ha mi yemar kedamritu, tfei mitoch kedei dibur. By the time you say the words, who says that it's like you say, you've already passed the kind of in the moment, you know, almost instantaneous window for backing off. And if you want to worm out of that by saying, v'chitema delo chashiv hefsek, you want to say, no, that doesn't count as elapsed time. It's like you've slapped down your chess move timer and, you know, the other person is moving and until they slap their timer down, your timer doesn't start again. So as long as the Beit Din is talking, mi yemar kedamritu, it's as if no time has passed. So you'll say, no, but we still, right, should be saying, that they have this ability to back out. Well, if so, lema achar kedei dibur amrinan laho. Ve'af agav de'en p'ticha zo mo'elet. Ula, basically, should have said, rather than rejecting Rav Yehuda's entire approach of mi yemar kedika amritu, He should have just said, well, I can only, right, I can only sort of accept the chasminan laho objection if we're talking about it being achar kedei dibur. That is to say, we wait a pregnant pause after they finish their testimony and then come in and say, who says it's really as you say, right? He should have said that that must be the way that we do it, right? To sort of address the getting them to back off their testimony. And fine, we would just say that pticha is not mo'elet. It's not going to actually have any effect in reversing the evidence in the trial. And Ula should have just said, yeah, you can say mi yemar kideka amritu. You can say who says it's like you said as a kind of formal flourish of we're looking out for the interests of the defendant, but you'll have to wait enough time such that the witnesses can no longer reverse themselves. But Ula does not do that. Ula just rejects Rav Yehuda outright. That is what Tosfot are saying here. And Tosfot's problem is therefore basically a combination of why does Ula outright reject Rav Yehuda? But they're also trying to understand how's it going to work if the testimony has already been entered. So we're going to answer that second, sort of both of those points here. The Yesh Lomar, the Havamatze L'Shanuye Hache Ela D'Shapir D'Mashane. One response you can give is, yeah, that was also a fatal flaw with Ula's objection. Just the Gemara didn't bother with it because it had another fatal flaw with Ula's objection. The Gemara responded to Ula by saying, what do you mean, chasminan laho? We do that all the time, okay? It had some other thing that it went after, and it just didn't bother to pursue this line of attack, and it basically knew that Rav Yehuda was going to disappear anyway from the record, so it didn't bother, you know, challenging Ula's challenge in this way. Ve'od yesh lomar, and further we could resolve that, De'ad shelo nechkera edutan beveidin, yecholin lomar mevudin anu. The alternative is to say, this is a case where their testimony has not yet been fully investigated by the Beit Din. That is to say that perhaps the principle of kevan sheyigid, shuveino chozeru magid, once you enter testimony, you can't retract it, is only after the testimony has been substantiated and checked. Kidetanya batosefta. There's a passage in the Tosefta that seems to suggest that that is the case. Miu bakuntros. However, Rashi explained diptichad zechut la'achar shedrashum v'chakrum uva'in li savelitein uchepirusho mashma beperak hayu bodkin dekatane im nimtzeu divrehem mechuvanim potchin. While there is this Tosefta that suggests that they can back out prior to being investigated, Rashi insists that it's after they've been investigated, and indeed, in the next chapter, it sounds like im nimtzu divrei mechuvanim. Once you've checked out their testimony as matching up, then potchin. Then you open the proceedings, and presumably that kicks off with this pticha lezechut, this sort of description, this declaration, or you know, question in favor of the defendant. Okay. So that Tosfot on some level is left a little bit hanging in that that second resolution is not really allowed to stand. And therefore what ends up really standing is this thing of, yeah, there's kind of a hole in the argument, but it must just be that they blasted past it because there were other holes in the argument that moved the discussion along, okay? So here I wanna just offer a kind of different perspective on this that I think is both helpful for understanding this Tosfot, but also for kind of understanding the structure of this. So I'm just going to switch to a different piece here. So here what I've done is just graphically mapped out the sugya in a way that I usually do when I'm preparing it, which is to kind of graphically clarify who is saying what here and to whom and in what kind of logical nesting. And this is a kind of sugya where that is extremely helpful for understanding and seeing what's going on. The main question here is Heichi Amrinan, right? What do we say to them? And then, as I pointed out when I was reading it, There are basically six answers, right? There is Rabbi Yehuda, there is Ula, there's Rabba, there's Rav Kahana, there's Abaye and Rava, and there's Rav Ashi. And then there's a braita at the end that supports Abaye and Rava, right? But if you look at the skeleton of the sugya, the main skeleton of the sugya is those six things. What do we say? Rabbi Yehuda has one suggestion, Miye Markedika Amritu. Ula has one suggestion, Yesh L'chaidim La'azimam. Rabba has a suggestion, Yesh L'chaidim La'achishan. Rav Kahana, Midivrechem Nizdake Ploni. Abai V'Rava, Ilo Katal T'lo Titchal. Rav Ashi, Kol Mishe Odeh Lo Zechut Yavo V'Yelamed Ala. All right? Those are the six things. If you pay attention, you'll realize the other pieces are kind of all supporting pieces. That is to say, we have an objection of Ula to Rav Yehuda, followed by a sub-objection that maybe Ula's objection is not sound. And then in the next line, a deflection of that sub-objection, allowing Ula to stand as an objection and to move us to resolution two. Similarly with Rabba, we've got an objection to Ula, and then a sub-objection to Rabba's objection, and then a deflection of that sub-objection, which restores the viability of Rabba's statement. And then we move on to Rabba, all right? Striking and interesting that you don't have any of that connective filler between these last ones, between 3, 4, 5, and 6. That is to say, the move from 1 to 2 to 3 is a move of, we can't say 1 because there's something wrong with it. We can't say 2 because there's something wrong with it. And that is signaled by the word Ela, which appears before these memrot. Ela, Amar Rabbi Ploni, indicates that we have rejected the thing that came before. But I think the thing that's interesting about the Tosfot is the Tosfot kind of point out that if you probe Ula's reasoning here, it doesn't actually come out completely logically coherent or consistent or kind of watertight in the way that you would expect, which is to say, Rav Yehuda seems like he's a little bit too easily thrown overboard in terms of the flow of the sugya. And Tosfot try to kind of resolve that. And one way of resolving it is to try to come up with a notion of, yeah, really properly understood, Ula has like a real fatal objection to Rav Yehuda. And that's why he moves on to what he says. And the same thing with Rabba. An alternate way of thinking about sugyot like this is that actually the Ula piece and the Rabba piece are basically artificial challenges that are developed by a later organizer of the sugya in order to try to give you a little bit of a backstory of, well, why did Ula feel like he needed to offer a new opinion? Why did Rabba feel like he needed to offer a new opinion? There must be some backstory there of them rejecting something that happened earlier, but that perhaps they didn't really say it, okay? If that feels odd, really, would anyone say that? So the Ramban says this in one of the places on his commentary. You can look it up on Shabbat Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph on your own if you want to see the context. But he has a similar sugya there, where basically there's an objection raised to one of the Amoraim, which he feels is weak or weird or problematic. He gets why you might have different opinions, but he doesn't really get why opinion two really defeats opinion one. And there, the characters involved are Rabba and Rav Chista, and he says something that's very helpful to just sort of know as a Talmudic methodology thing. He says, Rabba lav v'faruke kushya de Rav Chista ata. Rabba in this sugya, he's saying, is not really coming to engage the question raised by Rav Chista. The structure of that sugya is one Amora says something, Rav Chista challenges it, and then it seems like Rabba responds to Rav Chista's challenge, okay? But the Ramban points out that actually if you read Rabba closely, his answer does not fix Rav Chista's problem. Rather, what does he say? Lefaruke braita ata. Rabba is there coming to deal with the Braita that's the first part of the sugya, Vikushya lo shmi alei. And he never heard anything about the question that came before. Ve'ula ve'rabba tarvayu abraita kaime. Ula and Rabba, interestingly enough, it's the same people there. They both were responding to a shared problem in an earlier text, and this is the key phrase. Ugemara de kamisadar laho batar atkafta. It's the Gemara, it's sort of the final editor, who arranged these different comments as if they were responding to challenges that came earlier. And here the kicker, v'chein bimkomot harbe batalmud. And that happens actually, if you learn Gemara, all over the place, all the time. It's actually part of the flow of the thing, all right? So that's just another sort of perspective on what's happening in this sugya in terms of some of the structure that may be happening. And I think helps us see a little more clearly what we really have going on here is a six-part debate among Amoraim. How do we open with Zechut? And then, as a kind of follow-up to that, we have someone who beautifully kind of more fully embellished and edited this sugya, such that we might imagine how there might be some kind of back and forth to how this, you know, to how this came to be. Yeah, John, you're saying the Ramban doesn't offer a form genre reason. Do you have one you want to order offer?
I mean, I believe in a stama and a some sort of historical reasoning. I don't think the Ramban would, but it's interesting that like it's a little Ibn Ezra about sort of the secrets of the Torah, that they're sort of willing, they're sort of grasping at where we are in terms of if you're, I guess, an academic of the Talmud, but they don't really, but I doubt Rambam would be willing to hazard or think of the Gemara as wanting to accomplish some goal.
Yeah, so look, we could go to much larger kind of genre questions about the Gemara. You and I have had the chance to talk about some of this in some contexts of, you know, aspects of this that are about orality and the ways in which it's easier to remember things that have been linked together with a kind of flow of challenge and response as opposed to just sort of memorizing a list of things. There's aesthetic elements of this, of clearly we know from other Agadic passages, the rabbis of the Talmud felt that the give and take was a sort of beautiful form. They imagined that in the yeshiva shel mala, after people are gone from this world, the kinds of things they're doing is basically offering challenges and having them deflected. So there's a number of things. And look, I'm not ruling out that it's impossible that there was some kind of actual interaction here that is being preserved, but I'd say two things. One, and Monica asked this, like how many of them interact with each other? So I would say, yeah, Rabbi Yehuda and Ula and Rabba have some interactions with each other. I can't tell you off the top of my head how many clear live dialogue interactions are there between them. It's not sort of impossible on a chronological scale. It's not like Rabbi Yehuda and Ula for sure interact. They're in debates, right, and on all kinds of things. How much of it is live? Okay, that's a question you'd have to do a more thorough scan. But when you see that Ramban that I shared with you, to kind of notice that close comprehensive readers of the Talmud clearly noticed that this was something that happened. This was sort of part of the pattern. And to the extent it helps us solve an issue, right, solve a problem, that is to say, like what the Tosafot are engaging us on, which is, I'm not sure this totally coheres as a logical response to the problem, to the sugya, then it may be a better story, right? It may be a better backstory to say something like the Ramban than to try to hold it all together. Okay, let me pause there. Anything, because that's, we're really done with that sugya. And the next thing we're going to do is at least set ourselves up for the following sugya. Any comments or thoughts on that, on what it brings to the table or values into, you know, questions that it raises?
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it, but I think the point with the Ramban is, had he just made the point about this particular sugya, you could always say it's an ad hoc response. But once he says, V'chein b'mekomot harbe b'talmud, that means it's not really an ad hoc. It becomes a methodological observation about how the Talmud operates.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Any other reflections on, I don't know, the capital procedure? Any of the lawyers weigh in on sort of the retraction or modification of testimony midway through a trial? How's that dealt with?
I mean, this is more just a technical question. You know, there was this whole discussion of, well, when is this recanting? No, it was about the Edim Zomimim and about the defendant who would lie in wait until the verdict is locked in.
Right.
And turn the tables on the witnesses. Kind of begs the question, how long is there between verdict and execution? Because you gotta be quick. And also made me wonder, if you have a verdict but not the execution, is the verdict then undone upon the finding there were Edim Zomimim? You know, like, when has the train left the station? When has it not?
Okay, so in a way, this goes back to the Mishnah, right? Which is Dinei Nefashot Machzirin LeZechut. And there's a notion there of you kind of always go back in a capital case. So in that sense, as long as you haven't been executed, even if they're marching you out, right, to the Beit HaSkila, you can still do it, you know, sort of an appeal to the last moment. But yeah, I think the notion there is that if you feel you have, in other words, you'll be able to get the evidence in. That, I think, is not a concern in terms of how the procedure works. Now, you let it run all the way to the end, you better hope that that's your ace in the hole, because then you're not going to have another chance, right, if that fails.
I remember many years ago, that's why I remember it, because I don't remember what happened recently, there was, in DNA Israel, there was a review by Arnold Enker of Aaron Kirshenbaum's book on self-incrimination in Jewish law. And Enker there differentiated between sort of the halachic system and common law. Basically, common law, witnesses are evidence. Witnesses are already determined. They're evidence together with a lot of other evidence, which then the jury or the judge weighs the evidence. While in terms of halacha, the witnesses are really determined the verdict. The function of the judges is to make, as it were, to challenge, to test the witnesses' testimony. But once it withstands challenge, then it's the testimony of the witnesses which become which determine the verdict.
Great. So Eric here also gives something helpful. In American trials, attacks on testimony don't result in the testimony being stricken usually, but it just gives less weight, right? In keeping with what you were just saying. And so it's a different thing. But how about on this question, I guess, of can a witness reverse? Jerry, were you going to weigh in on that?
I was going to weigh in on just take a quick look at sort of the, who's the audience, right? Who's the question, right? The answers the Gemara is giving, the different alternatives, are actually aimed, or I think they may be addressing different audiences. Yesh l'cha yedim l'hachishan is directly at the defendant, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas, you know, Rav Kahana or whoever the last one was basically said, hey, does anybody have any other evidence? It's kind of like addressing whoever's assembled in the courtroom. It's just a completely different focus. And Abaye and Rav are kind of like, it, to my mind at least, it's a don't worry to the defendant, but maybe it's a reminder to the court of what, maybe they're addressing the court itself. You know, hey, this is our job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there may be different audiences there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And the Medivrechem Nizda Keploni is sort of the weirdest in that way, right? It's just sort of almost like, right, reminding yourself. And and that's why I was sort of hinting at, I think, to the extent you want to sort of extrapolate out from this, are they reflecting in some broader way on what it is to weigh in on someone's zechut? There's sort of both audience and mode. It's like the Medivrechem Nizda Keploni is almost like, the way you set up an environment that's to someone's zechut is you kind of make a proclamation that creates a sort of general umbrella of them feeling safe and like you've got their back. And in others, it's like, I'm going to do something that's going to take the, you know, adversary off your back. And in others, it's just, I can't change anything, but I can calm you down. All of those different kinds of things. Okay, great. Let's go on to sort of what is prep for the next sugya. We got another about 20 minutes here, and I mainly want to spend that on introducing the next sugya, I'm not sure how deep we will actually, how much, whether we'll even actually get to begin it. So going back to our Mishnah again, back here, going back to the Mishnah, we're now up to the next clause that we've got to analyze, which is, all right, so here again, we skip. The Mishnah goes on with Dinei Mamonot Matin al pi echad ben zechut lechova v'dinei nefashot matin al pi echad lezchut ve'al pi shnayim lechova. This is the sort of margin of vote, all right, distinction. That's not at least here going to be engaged by the Gemara, so we're just going to leave that piece on its own. And what we're moving on now to is to Dinei Mamonot Machzirin ben lezchut ben lechova. In monetary cases, you can send the case back. That is to say, undo the verdict. Whether it is going to be for zechut or for chova, we talked about it. This language seems to have to mean if there is a plaintiff who is trying to collect funds, right? Then zechut is issuing a ruling where right, the person who is being sued does not have to pay, whereas chova will be a ruling of, yes, you found them liable and they will have to pay. All right, so one way or the other, you can reverse the verdict if it's wrong, whereas dinei nefashot, you can only send the case back, retry it, reverse the verdict, et cetera, if you are going to acquit someone. But once someone has experienced a complete and total acquittal, you can get the political reference there. There's no way to retry that kind of thing in a dinei nefashot. Okay, great. So that allows us to switch to the background for what our next Gemara discussion is going to be. All right, so here I'm going to take you through two Mishnayot, which are going to be important for understanding questions of reversals or how we deal with cases that we think went awry, all right? And yeah, this is, we're gonna spend the rest of our time just doing these two texts, and that'll set us up next time to do what's a lengthy and somewhat complicated sugya. Okay, Mishnah and Bechorot. So here we're talking the local context, which is gonna fade pretty quickly, is the question of a Bechor, a firstborn animal, which when in perfectly good, healthy shape, has to be given to a Kohen. But when it, has to be offered as a sacrifice. But when it is a Baal Mum, when it gets, when it has some kind of blemish, okay, then it does not have to be offered as a sacrifice. It can be slaughtered and eaten by just anyone. All right, it's the Mamon of the Kohen, a whole set of rules around it that are not our issue here. Misha ino mumche, you need a certain expertise to be able to judge what is an animal that has a mum, that has a blemish, that will, you know, essentially change the status of the animal from consecrated to the psulei amukdashim, something that's no longer consecrated. If you're not a mumche, if you have no expertise, and you inspect a bechor, a firstborn animal, v'nishchat al piv, and they slaughter the animal, you know, based on that ruling. That is to say, they treat the ruling as a valid and efficacious ruling. That meat of that slaughtered bechor has to be buried in the ground, and that judge has to pay out of pocket to the kohen, basically, from whom it was taken. Okay? So, meaning, a mumche is the only person empowered to do this, some kind of expert. And if someone who is not authorized to do that goes ahead and issues a judgment, it is sort of nullified. Like you don't allow them, you don't allow the person that meat to be eaten. And the key thing here is v'yishalei mibeito, and he has to pay out of pocket for that judgment. Now, here's the relevant piece for us. This is a general statement about judges who make decisions. Danet adin, you offer a judgment. Zikat achaya v'chiyevet hazakai, timei atatahor v'tiheret atamei. And you mess it up. Someone who should have owed money, you tell them they're zakai, they're off the hook. Someone who should have been off the hook, you tell them they're chayav, they owe money. Something that was in reality tahor, you declare impure. Something that was impure, you declare pure. How do you deal with an erroneously decided case? Says the Mishnah, Masha sa sui v'yishalemi beito. The judgment is done. What's done is done. The judge issued an order, and that's it. The way it used to be in professional sports, okay? Umpire makes a call, that's the call. There's no instant replay, okay? However, it's an erroneous decision, so that judge then has to pay out of pocket. Meaning someone sues someone for $100. The judge awards the $100 to be paid to the plaintiff, and then it turns out that that's wrong. The $100 doesn't go back. The plaintiff keeps the $100. The judge makes the person who paid unfairly whole by paying out of pocket. However, im ayamum chelevet din patur milashalem. But if he is some kind of expert, and we're not getting into exactly what qualifies you to be that, but you've somehow been qualified in that regard, then you are exempt. One of the privileges of being a mumche is you are exempt. Okay, now we get a story which seems to be the origin of this principle, im haya mumche leveitim patur milashalem. Ma'ase bepara shenitla ha'em shela. There was a case of a cow that had its uterus removed, all right? Em, obviously the word for mother, but the part of the animal that mothers its calf, so it's the uterus. What's the problem? Well, potentially that kind of removal, an animal having a hysterectomy, potentially is a trefa, potentially renders it sort of chronically unwell in a way that it may not live very long. And an animal that's a trefa, you know, pegged as a formal definition as guaranteed to die or statistically guaranteed to die in the following 12 months, is treif, can't be eaten. So what happened? The case came to Rabbi Tarfon, ve'echila Rabbi Tarfon laklavim. He ordered that this cow's meat had to be fed to the dogs. All right? Basically, they slaughtered the cow, discovered it didn't have a uterus. He said, that's a treifa. Uvama selifnei chachamim ve'itirua. But the other sages who heard about this case, they said, what are you talking about? That should have been fine. Right? Note, he'echila laklavim seems like it means not just ordered that that happened, but he actually did it, okay? And that is to say, when the Chachamim had either the same case or a similar case, they said, hey, this should be fine. Enter the Alexandrian Jewish doctor Todos Harofe. Amar Todos Harofe, Ein para v'chazira yotza me'Alexandria ad shehem chotchin et ha'em shela bishvil shelo tele. There was a practice in Alexandria of making sure that every cow or pig that left the boundaries of the city or the region had a hysterectomy so that it would not give birth. What's the idea here? Basically, they think they have the best cows and pigs in the world, and they don't want anyone using their pigs and cows to breed their own of similar quality. So they essentially have an export ban on a, you know, normal, sort of able to give birth cow or pig. But what does the story prove? The story proves that a cow can live perfectly fine for many years without a uterus, okay? That is to say, they're clearly selling them, they're having them out there. Todos Harofe has to tell people, by the way, you know that cow you bought from Alexandria? Like, it doesn't have a uterus, in case you wondered why it can't reproduce. That's what's happening there. And therefore, Rabbi Tarfon realizes that the whole basis of his claim was wrong. And he says aloud to himself, Amar Rabbi Tarfon, halcha chamorcha Tarfon. Tarfon, there goes your donkey. Meaning, I'm going to have to pay. I cost this guy a cow. Yishalemi beito, he's going to come and seize my donkey as recompense for my erroneous decision. All right, so in other words, Rabbi Tarfon's assumption is when a judge makes issues an incorrect verdict and decision, he is personally liable and has to pay out of pocket. Rabbi Akiva comes to the rescue. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfa and Patur Ata. Shata mumche levei din. V'chola mumche levei din patur mida shalem. No, no, no. That rule that a judge has to pay out of pocket is only for a common judge. It's only for a misha ino mumche v'ra'a et ha-bechor. Okay? But the rule is dan et adin zikat achaya v'chiyevet azakai im aya mumche levei din patur mida shalem. So as I said, this is a Mishnah probably best understood, not as why did Rabbi Tarfon not know that line earlier in the Mishnah, but rather the line earlier in the Mishnah is probably Mishnat Rabbi Akiva, which reflects the codification of his approach and that of his students, which maybe innovatively, maybe based on a different line of tradition than Rabbi Tarfon had, simply asserts that, no, actually we give some protection to the Mumcha Levei Din to be able to make wrong decisions in terms of personal liability, right? They're shielded, basically, from that kind of liability. Okay, let me just pause there if there's a question. That Mishnah in Bichorot is important because it's one context of how we deal with reversing erroneous decisions, right? The thing that's going to be relevant for our sugya is, our sugya says, Dine mamonot machzirin. Bein l'schud, bein l'chova. Right? Basically, if you have a case decided and you think potentially incorrectly, you can reverse it. But what does the Mishnah in Bechorot say? Ma she'asah asui. What's done is done. Our sugya is going to say, those feel like they're incompatible. Right? Our Mishnah is going to be, dine mamonot. New evidence, reverse it this way, that way, doesn't matter. But here the Mishnah Bechorot seems to say, what do you mean? You don't reverse cases. The only axis the Mishnah Bechorot seems to be talking about is whether the judge pays. But a verdict is a verdict even in Dine Mamono. All right, that seems to be what's being said here. And John, you're saying if it's a Mishnah, shouldn't it be Rabbi Meir or the Chachamim will bring that line to Rabbi Tarfon? Say, maybe just unmute yourself and say what you mean.
That if it's the opinion of the, if it's the first opinion of the Mishnah and it seems to be the general opinion of the Mishnah, bringing in the name of Rabbi Akiva, and then your point about it being Rabbi Akiva's school or opinion seems strange, because I would have thought if the Mishnah is just stating it anonymously, then putting in Rabbi Akiva's mouth seems to weaken the strength of the position.
Yeah, well, this is a larger question of what's the role of ma'asim in the Mishnah. That is to say, when a thing says ma'aseh, here's a story, should that be understood as responding what came before? A lot of scholars think that if we want to just understand historically how the Mishnah came together, that actually the ma'asim, those stories, are kind of folded in. It's almost like they were preserved in an independent line, and they're then folded in to emerging collections of teachings that are formulated more sort of theoretically, abstractly, as opposed to in real life. So I'm saying something that's sort of in keeping with that approach, which is that the opening line of the Mishnah just reflects basically the conclusion of the story. And since we know, and you know, rabbinic sources themselves talk about this, that one of the main sort of pillars or one of the main kind of collections on which our whole Mishnah is built is Mishnat Rabbi Akiva, some, you know, sort of larger effort that he made to organize all kinds of things. That seems like a way that it makes sense and doesn't make Rabbi Tarfon ignorant of an earlier point. But the question of attribution is always somewhat tricky in that regard. Yeah, the Mumcha Levei Din is right. Something like, I think Emily's suggestion is not bad. It's hard to know exactly what's happening here. It's not as if the Roman authorities are, you know, really granting that. So it's probably some kind of self-policing thing that, you know, various circles of people listen to more or less. Maybe think about it as like, you know, a Heksher sort of economy for people and judges, which is a little bit self-policing, a little built based on social capital, social gravity, etc. Let's see one last thing here, the Mishnah in Eduyot, and with this we'll wrap. Famous text, but sort of important again for our reversal piece. Ask the Mishnah in Eduyot a meta question about how the entire Mishnah is structured. V'lama mazkirin divrei yachid bein amirubin, ho'il ve'ein halacha ala kedivrei amirubin. Why do we have these Mishnayot that say Rabbi Meir says this, but Chachamim say that? Or an anonymous text says this, but Rabbi Eliezer said that. Why bother? Given that we know that the halacha is always going to follow the majority against the lone view of an individual, why bother preserving them in the Mishnah? She'im yir'e beidina divrei yachid v'yismoch alav. Because there will be cases where a later court will think that the logic of the minority opinion makes sense. That's one way of reading yir'e. That is to say, they just think that's more right. Or in a case where they feel it will be important to rely on it, they find it, they see it, and they're like, oh, we could use that. You need to leave those minority opinions there to potentially be revived by later courts. And this is a tricky phrase. We won't get to totally breaking down all the ways you can read it. She'ein beit din yachol levatel divrei beit din chavero al she'iyah gadol imenu bechokhma uvinyan, because for no court can cancel or nullify or override or overrule the words of a fellow court unless it is greater than it in wisdom and in number. Now, briefly, there's sort of two ways of reading that phrase. Either it means, since there's no general power of overriding based on brute force alone, unless you are greater in wisdom and number, we need to leave the minority opinions in there, because when you're talking about relying on a minority opinion as precedent, then lesser courts are allowed to overrule earlier courts, because they're not really overruling them, they're just getting back into the weeds of the argument based on an earlier sage. Or a Beit Din can never overrule in any way, and therefore you need the Divrei HaYachid, this minority opinion, just to do a kind of like ad hoc reliance on it when you have no way to override, right? Or there's even a way of reading it that even a court that's greater in wisdom and number can only override another court if it has a minority opinion to rely on. That's not our issue here, to get to the plain sense of Mishnah Eduyot. What's important to us is that here, there does seem to be some notion that, other than cases of Gadol Mimenu Bechokhma Uveminyan, where there's a later court that is somehow wiser and more numerous than an earlier court, there is no reversal of cases. And that too sits in tension potentially with our Mishnah, which seems to say, Dine Mamanot, Machzirin, go ahead, undo the verdict. You think something's wrong? You think something is inaccurate? So go ahead, you can revisit. All right? So those are going to be important for next time, because the way our Mishnah, the way our sugya is going to begin, and we'll retread this next time, is by pitting the Mishnah in Sanhedrin against the Mishnah in Bechorot. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin says, Machzirin, go ahead, reverse it, overturn it. And the Mishnah in Bechorot says, Masha'asa asui, it's done. What's done is done, and then meanders off into a discussion of who has to pay and who's responsible. So our sugya is going to want to know, hey, what's going on? When can you overrule cases, and when can't you? Excited to see everyone next week. Have a wonderful evening. Thanks for being here.